About a month ago, I was working on a talk on mindfulness of emotions. And in the week preceding, I got completely caught up in some really intense moods and emotions. A couple weeks later, I was writing a talk on mindfulness of thoughts and noticed I was getting swept up in obsessive thinking. The title of this talk is Transforming Your Relationship to Pain. So last week, I got a three-day migraine, and last night, as I was just getting ready to go to sleep, feeling so tired after a really full day, I discovered a tick embedded into my thigh. So it wasn't a deer tick, it was one of the big ticks. It was about like 2 or 3 inches across, maybe. And so for the next 20 minutes, Tara and I took turns digging pieces of this tick out of my thigh. So you may want to stay in tune for my next talk. It's going to be on the never-ending, ever-expanding permanent bliss states. One of my favorite meditation teachers said that if you sit still long enough with your eyes closed, something's going to happen. And from what I've heard in the group interviews and with the individual interviews, a lot has happened. Some insights, some non-ordinary states, some waves of gratitude. And inevitably, pain comes up in our experience as well. And then, of course, the mind creates issues about the pain. And then we're dealing with the first noble truth, that there is pain in life, that there is suffering in life. Normally, we're caught up in some kind of endless and actually a pretty predictable reactions to pain. But when we have the tools of concentration and mindfulness, you start to see your issues, and you start to see how you're relating to them. And chances are pretty good after 3 full days of practice that your capacity to stay present, your capacity to be aware without judgment, are deepening. And perhaps you've seen more and more into those classic reactive patterns, which Larry mentioned last night, of getting swept away in all the different flavors of aversion, of anger, judgment, blame, ill will, hatred, and getting caught in all the flavors of wanting, of craving, of planning, of fantasy, sense pleasures. All the times we get lost in worry and anxiety and that restless, agitated mind. The times we get caught in sloth and torpor, a sense of heaviness, a sense of disconnection, a sense of sleepiness, a quality of numbness that inevitably finds its way into our experience. And chances are you spend some time under the influence of doubt and criticism, either doubting or criticizing yourself or finding something external that you find the mind fixating on. And yet, with all these changing weather systems in these days of practice, something's transforming. Something's shifting. I was once asked if this practice is therapy. And I was reminded that Freud said that in his view, it's about taking neurotic individuals and bringing them to an ordinary level of unhappiness. And meditation is about taking you from ordinary unhappiness to a place where there is no unhappiness and there is no suffering. It's a radical difference and it's a radical practice. I would imagine that you've felt all different forms of pain in these past days. Physical pain, emotional pain, mental anguish. They all have their place as they come and go. And the more we sit, the more we recognize this kind of fundamental quality of suffering. And inevitably, we see into the second insight, the second noble truth, that there's a cause for that suffering. It has to do with attachment, with clinging, with identification and inability to let go. And we all know that space. Even when we know we have to let go, we can't let go. We find ourselves caught on the hamster wheel, on repetitive thoughts, repetitive beliefs that came cycling through again and again and again. So tonight I'd like to share a little bit about some strategies of how you can transform your relationship to pain. We'll try a few techniques so you can try them out. Some may be contradictory to each other, and some may not resonate for you at all. But I remember my very first Vipassana retreat. And one of the first things that was said was to give yourself fully with an open mind, and then later evaluate if there was anything of value. So this is an invitation to explore with an open mind, and then evaluate later, and to listen with the body and just sense what's true for you. So it's interesting to explore what happens when we encounter pain. I'm not a medical person. My training in anatomy and physiology kind of goes back to the head bones connected to the neck bones connected to the shoulder bone. But I think I can safely say that pain is generally described as a signal from the body for attention. And it's often a signal to stop what you're doing. It's a feedback loop in your relationship to life around you. And there's this amazing physiology of the mind-body connection. When you take a sip of boiling hot tea, it's astounding how fast the nerves sense the intensity of the sensation, send that through the nervous system to the brain to let you know that it's time to stop doing that. And what I find fascinating is how pain can be seen as a psychobiological event. It lives in the body and it lives in the mind. If you smash your foot into the sofa, that sensation lives in the body, but it also lives in the mind. If you're an aversive type, it'll live in the mind with the thought of, who's the idiot who put that sofa there? If you're more of a self-critical type, it might be living in the mind with the thought, I'm such an idiot. How could I have done something so stupid? With emotional pain, for example, in encountering really deep loss, that emotion lives in the body. And even in mental states, that mental obsessing about work, if you hang out with it and you investigate that mental state, you may find over time that you can locate it inside. You might sense underneath that mental state of obsessive thinking an emotional quality of anxiety or an emotional quality of fear. And you might be able to sense it as a physical manifestation, as a nervous fluttering belly or tight breath. Your issues really are in your tissues. I've been offering some trainings with Dr. Gary Kaplan from the Kaplan Institute for Integrative Medicine in McLean, Virginia. Our first six-week program was called Medical Meditation, and we measured cortisol levels before and after the participants took the program. Before and after, and they also filled out a survey called the SF36, which is kind of a standard questionnaire to sort of measure emotional response as well. What was really quite exciting, and not all that surprising, was after just 6 weeks of practice, we were able to demonstrate a statistically significant drop in cortisol levels. And now we're focusing on a specific mindfulness techniques that can shift relationship to pain. A lot of people who work with Dr. Kaplan have chronic pain. And I had to ask myself if I'm really qualified to teach about mindfulness and pain. I'm mostly really healthy. The only two nights I spent in the hospital were the first two of my incarnation with my mother. I'm not taking any prescriptions. I've been on antibiotics maybe a handful of times in my life. And I know so many people who deal with chronic pain, and my stuff seemed pretty trivial in comparison. So I decided to do a little inventory. Pain really falls into two categories. There's acute pain and chronic pain. The acute pain is the pain that you can kind of fix and kind of move on. The chronic is what sort of stays with you. And most of my pain has been acute. I grew up on a farm. I managed a 1,000-acre farm all through college. I did a fair bit of extreme sports like technical rock climbing and mountain biking, and rode a motorcycle for most of my life. So here's my inventory of acute pain. A broken foot, broken toes, broken wrist, broken fingers, fractured elbow, cracked ribs, more or less three concussions, torn ACL. I've been gouged and burned and cut from farm equipment and bitten and kicked by animals. I've had amoebic dysentery and early stage malaria in Africa. And I twice went into anaphylactic shock from bee stings, where I was revived in the emergency room. But I thought, well, that was when I was young and cavalier. I've been a lot more cautious recently. So in the last 3 years, while being cautious, colds, muscle spasms, bronchitis. I slid out on my motorcycle in a rainstorm on a tight curve and really messed up my wrist. 2 years ago, I got salmonella from a chicken roll-up in an airport. I needed intravenous fluids. And then again last night, digging that tick out of my thigh. I think the worst pain that I was in was when I had dengue fever in West Africa. It's called breakbone fever. I was having dinner with some friends, and in the middle of the dinner I said, you know, I think I really need to lie down, and I just sort of collapsed. And I woke up about 18 hours later, and it literally felt like people were breaking my bones with lead pipes all night long. Just exquisite pain. And I understand that my litany doesn't stack up against childbirth. So I offer a deep bow to all mothers out there. I had a good friend of mine tell me how with her first child, she was in labor for something, you know, a couple hundred hours or something. And she was in so much desperation that she grabbed the nurse's hand and said, just tell me I can do this. And this woman looked her in the eye and said, I have four children. And like from that sort of transmission, she got the will to move through it and went through the birth. And before she left the hospital, she went to find the nurse and said, that moment really saved my life. And this woman just sort of like, she sort of blushed and she said, I don't have any children. I couldn't think of anything else to say. So there's acute pain. We can fix it and move on. And chronic pain is a different thing. And personally, I know a little bit about that, having migraines since I was about six, which can really be quite crippling. When you reflect on your body, all that you have been through with your body, all the different experiences of pain that you've encountered, the temporary acute pain, the chronic pain, if we were to add it all up, it would be extraordinary what we experience in the realm of just physical pain. I used to do a training on holistic health teacher training, and we'd have people lie down and they'd outline their body and then make a map of their history of pain. And it's really quite extraordinary how close pain is to our day-to-day life. So last night, Larry was talking about equanimity. Equanimity is considered the flower of this practice. It's your capacity to be with anything, to be with all things equally. When it comes to pain, we all have our own strategies. Mine was to ignore it. Growing up in the Pennsylvania Dutch country on a farm, the basic strategy was ignore it, and if it's still there 2 weeks later, then maybe you can pay attention to it. But all of the hindrances become activated around pain. We find ourselves caught in aversion. Why me? We're craving for it to be different, to do anything that will help us to relieve the intensity of those sensations. We get caught in worry and in anxiety around our pain and our health. Or we find ourselves wanting to check out, just to kind of release ourselves, to fall asleep, to go numb. Or we get caught in doubt and criticism. What did I do wrong for this to happen? Much of the time, we manage to override all this unpleasantness. We stay busy. We stay numb. We stay angry. Or we stay addicted to things that distract us from what's happening right here and right now. Or we stay locked into old patterns that help us to cope, but we don't feel fully alive. We don't feel fully awake. Tara calls this the trance. Khalil Gibran said that unless you truly pause, in this life you will laugh, but not all your laughter. You will cry, but not all your tears. The last thing we are inclined to do is to turn our attention directly to the pain and explore what we can learn about ourselves. I'd like to dedicate a little bit of time as to how we can do that, how we can explore some specific ways we can shift our relationship to pain. And this leads us to the third noble truth. It is possible to be free from suffering. Meditation has made all kinds of headlines these days. All the slicing and dicing and study of what happens in the brain when you practice these attentional trainings is really quite remarkable. Just a few headlines that I just found at the top of the list on a Google search. Meditation reduces the emotional impact of pain. You can think your way out of pain. Meditation, a powerful tool against pain. Meditation leads to greater pain relief than morphine. Just a few headlines. So I read some of these studies, or at least some of the articles about them, to really find out what exactly are they doing? How are they discerning all of this? And there's an interesting piece I wanted to share with you. I found really pretty interesting. A postdoctoral research fellow at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center is the lead author of this study. He was quoted on Science Daily as saying, "We found a big effect, about a 40% reduction in pain intensity and a 57% reduction in pain unpleasantness. Meditation produced a greater reduction in pain even than morphine or other pain-relieving drugs, which typically reduce pain ratings by about 25%. The participants attended four 20-minute classes. They had never meditated before, but were taught a form of mindfulness meditation in which they paid attention to their breath, but not to distracting thoughts or feelings. This is sometimes called focused attention. Instead of the typical MRI scan, a scan called arterial spin labeling magnetic resonance imaging was used that maps meditation results better. All the 15 participants demonstrated a lessening of pain from 11% to 93%. Here's the line that just slayed me. The pain was introduced by a heat-producing device that caused pain when placed on one leg. So I thought, how were they doing that study? So, Mrs. Smith, if you could just watch your breath, and at some random point, I'm going to take this hot poker and jam it into your leg. But somehow that study worked. I've got to find out more about how they did that. With just a little bit of training, they learned to stay present in the face of unpleasant sensation. And the truth is, we can let go. Intuitively, we know this because we've done it before. Some things that have bugged you no longer bugged you. Somehow you shifted your relationship to it. And one of our groups, someone was sharing how excited they were to be coming here to sleep outside, and how much they love being just sort of immersed in nature sounds. And what she heard the first week was nothing but heating units and the sound of trucks grinding their gears coming up the hill. And she shared about how she noticed her disappointment and let it go. Equanimity came flowing right back in. This seems to be our work, to explore how we can let go. I've studied with a number of teachers in my life, and I have a current teacher I wanted to acknowledge. I've been studying with him daily for just under 15 years. His teaching style is not heavy on Dharma. He prefers to teach more through example. I'm talking about my dog. And we have another elderly dog in our family as well, who's a wonderful teacher. So my dog is just under 15 years old. He's deaf. He's mostly blind now. He was one of the most athletic dogs I ever knew. He had a very strong hunting gene. A very strong hunting gene. If he saw a deer before, he would run it down and eat it. That's kind of what he was designed for. So we have a lot of deer on our property. So now when he goes outside, the deer hardly look up from grazing. He is no longer a threat. He was about 110 pounds in his prime, and now he's about 65 pounds. And he's wasting away. He walks like a drunk, and we're constantly having to kind of rearrange his legs when he lies down because he has so little control over them. But apparently, he deals with pain a lot differently than I do. He doesn't seem to be consumed by worry. He doesn't seem to be lost in judgment. He doesn't seem to dwell on his days when he was more strong and studly. He still loves to go out. His sense of smell is still good. He seems to savor his adventures, even though they might be walking 500 yards. And he still loves his meals. Have you noticed how gracefully animals deal with pain and deal with aging? There's something here about equanimity, about the capacity to be with anything. We can't talk about pain without talking about the teaching of the second arrow. And I wanted to read a little bit of what the Buddha said from a translation, just to read some sections. And of course, the language is always masculine, he. I'll just leave it as he, and you can fill in the blanks. When touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental. As he is touched by that painful feeling, he is resistant. Any resistance obsession with regard to that painful feeling obsesses him. Touched by that painful feeling, he delights in sensual pleasure. Why is that? Because the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person does not discern any escape from painful feeling aside from sensual pleasure. As he is delighting in sensual pleasure, any passion, obsession in regard to that feeling of pleasure obsesses him. Sensing a feeling of pleasure, he senses it as though joined with it. Sensing a feeling of pain, he senses it as though joined with it. Sensing a feeling of neutral sensation, he senses it as though joined with it. This is called an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person joined with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, pains, distress, and despair. He is joined with suffering and stress. Now, the well-instructed, when touched with feeling of pain, does not sorrow, grieve, and lament, does not beat his breast or become distraught. So he feels one pain, physical, but not mental. Just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward did not shoot a second arrow, so that he would feel the touch of only one arrow. As he is touched by that painful feeling, he is not resistant. Sensing a feeling of pleasure, he senses it disjoined from it. Sensing a feeling of pain, he senses it disjoined from it. This is the distinguishing factor between the well-instructed practitioner and the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill practitioner. So when I thought about that, my first thought was, well, I guess I'm just run-of-the-mill. Because I see how many times I react mentally. How many times when I feel pain, I get lost in some reactive pattern. This is a powerful teaching. When we feel sensation with resistance, we suffer. And it is so easy to beat ourselves up around this teaching. All of our conditioning goes against it, but we can practice. Let's just take a moment to do a little experiment. If you like, you can close your eyes. We'll take just a moment or two. If you like, you might bring your attention into this felt sense of your body right now. Noting whatever sensations feel most predominant. Can you be with these sensations without a story? Can you experience these sensations, the vibration of sound, the sense of the air against your skin? Any perception of cool or warmth, of tingling, vibration, pulsing? Can you experience it as pure sensation, as pure energy? inevitably the mind will come in to make a comment, to judge or compare. The practice is to feel sensation without adding anything to it from the mind. If you like, you can deepen the breath and let the eyes open, or if you wish, you can remain with the eyes closed. This practice of bare attention, to be in the direct experience of sensation, without a past, without a future, without a story, is a very delicate space to hold. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the attentional training, some of the different practices or techniques that we can explore. When we experience strong, unpleasant sensation, again, our habitual way is to turn away from it, to try and nuke it or distract ourselves. When we turn our attention to it, there are a number of factors that are important. And I found, you know, in Buddhism there are all kinds of lists. I just wanted to kind of honor what are called the seven factors of awakening, because I find that these seven factors kind of have to be in place for us to kind of successfully investigate our experience, particularly when it has a very strong charge to it. And just to name them briefly, we require a quality of mindfulness to kind of be awake and present, a quality of investigation or a quality of curiosity to really look into the nature of what is true. We need energy. We have to have energy to do this kind of investigation. A quality of joy or a quality of rapture is important. A quality of relaxation, and at the same time, a quality of concentration, and a quality of equanimity to really be with whatever arises. These are lots of factors, but I have found it helpful for myself to recognize that the times when I can't really be with what is there, that there is something missing. And sometimes it's just energy. I don't have the energy to investigate something unpleasant, or it feels too overwhelming. I'm going to talk a little bit about really sensing if it's the right time to investigate pain or unpleasant sensation. Yeah. A quality of mindfulness, to be aware. A quality of curiosity or investigation. We require energy, joy, relaxation, concentration, and equanimity. So I'd like to put this in the context of rain, of recognizing, allowing, investigating, and non-identification, or kind of natural awareness. And just to kind of tease out some of the qualities of each of these. Recognizing or realizing what is here is really cultivating the faculty of wisdom, the capacity to recognize what is true, not your preference, not your embellishment, but what is actually true. And there are certain strategic qualities we can practice here. Noting and labeling are perhaps the most powerful. To actually give your experience a name can be quite powerful. In the shamanic traditions, they say that when you can name a fear, you take its power away, or you begin to take its power away. Kind of a very powerful way of developing your awareness as the witness, your capacity to observe, to disidentify a little bit from your experience, to be able to observe it from outside rather than from inside. It sets us up for a very powerful distinction between, for example, I am angry to I am feeling anger. There's a world of difference between the two. The capacity to observe, the capacity to kind of set ourselves up for the possibility of equanimity. And when we focus on recognizing what is here, we're recognizing not just what's actually happening, but we're also opening our capacity to observe the attitude in our mind, to observe how we're holding our experience, whether it be with aversion or a quality of clinging or a quality of confusion. You may recall there have been instructions at different times to simply pause and observe the attitude in your mind. When we explore the whole realm of allowing and accepting, this is cultivating the whole wing of compassion, the whole realm of the heart. And particularly on retreat, when we are getting very calm and very open, I find it particularly helpful when it comes to physical pain or emotional pain or mental anguish to first ask, does it feel okay? Does it feel safe to be with this? It's a very important question. Sometimes it may not be, and that is absolutely okay. Another time, the conditions might be different when you might have the capacity to be with and investigate that unpleasant or painful experience. Inevitably, when we explore unpleasant sensation, there is some form of clenching. There is some form of tightening. In the Tibetan tradition, they call it shempa, just this internal clenching. When we explore allowing or accepting, can you say internally, I care about this? Another very powerful thing to keep in mind is, can you drop a label of this being good or bad? And I got to explore this a little bit as we were digging out the tick. When we think of acceptance is your capacity to be with just with what is. When we explore sensation, Joseph Goldstein says there are really only three options when you're exploring physical pain. It's either going to get worse, it's going to get better, or it's going to stay the same. So as I was meditating this morning, there was a lot of sensation around the tick bite. So I decided to watch it, to label it, to sort of see if I could describe it, to really stay with it as intimately as I could. And I noticed that it got worse. The pain got a lot more intense. And then it started getting better. And I noticed I was getting kind of pleased with myself for what I thought I was doing. And then I remembered something the third Zen patriarch said. He said, the disease of the mind is to set up what you like against what you don't like. And then I started wondering, well, what I'm calling unpleasant, are these actually bad sensations? And then I thought, well, maybe this unpleasant sensation of like burning, tingling, sort of a chewing feeling, maybe that's actually like the healing action. Maybe that's actually like the white blood cells rushing in there to fight the infection And then I thought, well, what if the unpleasant is actually the sign of a really healthy body? And then I started getting a little worried. Maybe I should be feeling more unpleasant sensation. And maybe all that sort of like healing thing I was doing was actually not a good thing. It got really confusing there for a few moments. To drop the sense of good or bad allows us to be in the direct experience of what is there. Can you welcome the experience of pain or unpleasant? Last night, Larry read from The Guest House, Rumi's poem on how meditation is kind of like running a B&B. You never know who's going to show up at the door. And Rumi says, welcome all these experiences at the door and let them in, for even though they may steal your furniture, they may be clearing you out for some new delight. Have you noticed sometimes after a cold or after a flu or after a migraine, once it's all done, you actually feel clearer and lighter than you did before? Oftentimes the message of pain is to slow down and pay attention. And something happens in that forced inner listening that we do. Father Thomas Keating talks of how meditation is the practice of consent, of consenting to whatever arises. So as we explore accepting and allowing, there's a very deep inquiry as to how intimate you can be with this new relationship that you're establishing with sensation. And there are some questions that I have found helpful in my own inquiry and that I've shared with others. When you can contact the unpleasant sensation, simply to ask, how can I care for this right now? How does this sensation want me to be with it right now? What does this need from me right now? I find that those questions can set up a very intimate relationship with those sensations. Another exploration can be to explore what compassion feels like inside. When you stub your toe, notice the difference of how long the healing takes. If you contrast holding your experience with negativity and judgment and blame, or actually holding the sensation of that stubbed toe with care. And we'll explore a little bit more of what it's like to actually look through the lens of loving kindness and loving presence. There's a particular strategy that I have at times found extraordinary for opening my heart to my experience. And that is to ask, if you can remember, to ask yourself, do other people feel this too? Do other people feel this too? Back in April, my old guy had a stroke, and it was kind of late at night on a Sunday, and we put him in the car, we're taking him to the hospital, and just as I was pulling out onto, you know, one of the smaller roads where we live, some black SUV pulled in front of me, and the speed limit was about 45, and for some reason this SUV was going 25. And Tara was in the back with the dog, and I was very, very much leaning forward and trying to figure out how I could get around this car with a very, very high state of agitation. And there was no opportunity to pass this car. So I was forced to go 25 when I could be going at least 45. And then something kind of clicked inside. And I just thought, oh, this is the black SUV of death telling me to slow down. And so I actively slowed down. And then I remember that question. Or really it's more of a statement. Other people feel this too. And suddenly I realized I was not the only person in the world whose dog was possibly dying. That question opened me to realize that my experience was part of a greater experience that many others had held. And something in that slowing down allowed me to be more present. It allowed me to actually have my experience of those kind of precious moments in the car. Recognizing what is here, naming, labeling, exploring how we can open our heart to our experience, allows us to deepen our investigation. And this is really the realm of Vipassana, to explore more and more intimately how you're relating to your experience. And again, in this investigation, it's so important to ask if it feels safe, if it feels okay to be with this unpleasantness. Sometimes it's not, and that's okay. I find sometimes contacting an experience of unpleasantness or pain, there's an analogy that it's kind of like coming in contact with an animal, a wild animal at the edge of the woods. You can't chase after it, you can't lure it in, but you can let it know you see it. And if by chance you encounter something that feels too much, feels too big, it can be a very beautiful process of acknowledging it, letting it know you see it, and then turning your attention in some way to take a walk, to get a cup of tea, just to shift your attention. And when the time is right, to really trust that it will return again at another time. So there's something here I find in the art of investigation about simply keeping company with my experience, abiding with that experience. Can you be with the unpleasantness? Can you be with the pain without adding a second arrow? Can you adjust your breath in a way that allows you simply to be with it? Can you discern between what is physical and what is mental? Sometimes powerful insights can arise in that inquiry. Perhaps the most powerful thing I have found to kind of summarize this is to explore what it's like to look through the lens of awareness, to simply be present with what is there, with the physical reality of the sensation. And then to explore what it's like to look through the lens of loving presence. When you hold your experience with a quality of loving presence, how does it shift? How does it move? How does it change? Loving presence is somehow, it's some kind of lubrication that allows us to stay with our experience, that can give it permission to shift and move. When we're exploring strong, unpleasant sensation, we can explore with a sense of holding something in the foreground and the background. Just to touch on this briefly, when we were digging the tick out of my leg, I keep coming back to that tick. It was Tara's turn to dig for a while. And as she was kind of wielding the tweezers, I kind of remembered when I got a shot, and when I was maybe 5 or 6, and I remember this really clearly. Just before the doctor gave me the shot, he said, "Think of a white horse." So I thought of a white horse, and I didn't even feel the shot. But what I realized was that all of my attention was being drawn to the tick bite, to the anticipation of that, the point of that tweezer going right in there. And so what I did is I shifted my attention to sort of feel my whole leg. And by sort of opening my attention to feel the whole leg, I was still aware of the sensation, but it changed it from sort of like a narrow focus to a broader focus. And that made a very powerful experiment for me there. So when you feel strong sensation, it can be very powerful to feel the space around it. And we're going to close with a little reflection on a way that we can explore what it's like to hold your attention sort of around unpleasant sensation. In fact, why don't we do that now? If you like, you can close your eyes. As you lightly scan through the body, you might just sense this play of vedana, these three qualities: that which is unpleasant, that which you find pleasant, and that which you find neutral. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And you might like to find a place. While you may not be feeling unpleasant, you might focus on a place inside where the sensations are most predominant. And you might just take a moment to kind of just to recognize the quality of that sensation. Can you find a word or two that describes what it feels like? You might inquire as to whether it feels right, if it feels safe or okay to be with it a little bit more. If you were to consent to this sensation, if you were to say yes to it, how does it shift or change or move? If you were to find a way to keep it company, maybe to adjust your breath in a way that allows you to kind of abide with it, simply to be with the direct experience of the sensation, how does it shift or move or change? If you were to hold this in a quality of loving presence, how does it shift or move or change? And if you find the sensation has melted or disappeared or morphed, you might move to another place in the body where you feel sensation the most predominant. Can you feel the location of this sensation? Can you feel the space around it? As we cultivate our capacity to recognize what is here, to open our awareness, to open ourselves, to be present with it if it feels right, to accept and to allow, as our concentration and mindfulness deepens, our capacity to investigate becomes more refined, becomes sharper, to sense more and more intimately the qualities of this moment and how we're relating to it. Recognizing, allowing, investigating can lead us to a place of non-identification, to a quality of natural awareness. And these are the moments where we might experience a shift from my pain to simply pain. The sense of subject and object can fall away. The sense of I and mine falls away. In those moments, we can sense who we are in the absence of judgment, in the absence of comparison, in the absence of wanting it differently. I'd like to close with a short poem. As we sense this quality of compassion for ourselves, as we open to our true nature, inevitably that sense of compassion opens to those around us. A man crosses the street in rain, stepping gently, looking two times north and south, because his son is asleep on his shoulder. No car must splash him. No car drive too near his shadow. This man carries the world's most sensitive cargo, but he's not marked. Nowhere does his jacket say fragile, handle with care. His ear fills up with breathing. He hears the hum of a boy's dream deep inside him. We are not going to be able to live in this world if we're not willing to do what he's doing with one another. The road will only be wide. The rain will never stop falling. Close with just a brief meditation. Sensing the aliveness of sensation. And sensing, however it may manifest for you, the quality of presence. In your own way, sensing these two qualities, the quality of wisdom, to recognize what is true, the quality of compassion, capacity to allow, to make room for.